It's Saturday, April 13th, 2002, 3 p.m. We're in Portland, Oregon with Mike Rupert. He's a former LAPD narcotics investigator who discovered CIA trafficking in drugs in 1977 and is now one of the most prominent investigators of the September 11th attacks. I just want to verify that it is okay to use this footage in video or audio transcript form.
IMC can do anything with this footage they want to, with my complete blessing.
Thank you. Well, to start out, I guess the first question I hear most often from your critics is, why would the U.S. government bomb its own people? Isn't that outside the pale of how the U.S. government would seek to, of what they would do?
Well, let's rephrase the question to say, why would the U.S. government allow its own people to be bombed?
Okay.
I've never said that there were American pilots crashing the planes into the World Trade Center. I have said specifically and clearly that there's evidence that the U.S. government knowingly allowed the attacks to happen as a pretext for generating a war that it could not have secured the blessings for under any other means. Historical precedents include Pearl Harbor. We know that the Roosevelt administration knew that the Japanese were going to attack and allowed it to happen. The FOIA documents released clearly indicate that. There are several good books. History Channel is running a story on it. We have Operation Northwoods, top secret declassified documents from 1962 showing that the Joint Chiefs had a plan to attack American aircraft and facilities and blame it on Castro. So this is real politics, the way wars have always been played throughout history. This is nothing new. And here, what was at stake was Central Asian oil and control of the drug trade.
You mentioned the Project Northwoods. I have seen people assert that that was just a plan by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that was eventually vetoed by the government, and they use that to assert that as they use that as proof to say that is proof that the government would not allow such a thing to happen.
Well, the fact that it was drafted into a complete operational plan and classified top secret is proof in and of itself that members of the government think that way.
Do you feel that times have changed somewhat so that it's do you see certain factions of the government having more power these days that would allow them to carry out such operations instead of having them circumvented by some sort of moral code?
I think it's probably better to say that circumstances have changed.
What circumstances?
The imperative has changed. Castro was an inconvenient nuisance to conservative elements in the government in the 60s. He was not a threat to American national security. However, as we enter the 21st century, the access to vast, untapped Central Asian oil fields at a time when the world was on the edge of a monstrous global oil crisis made it a completely different risk issue. There was much more at stake. It was essential for the major oil companies like Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, Texaco, BP, Amoco to get access to that oil, without which the global economy might have collapsed. So the stakes were much higher.
Besides Cynthia McKinney, who we were just discussing, came out with another statement yesterday and had an article in the Washington Post about her call for a complete investigation in 911 and her implication that there was complicity within the government or possible complicity within the government to allow 911 to happen. Besides Cynthia McKinney, do you know of any other legislators like Barbara Lee or any other officials that have come out and asked for a far-reaching investigation of possible complicity?
None have officially or publicly yet. I can tell you that I've traveled to Washington. I have 20 members of Congress who subscribed to my newsletter, and I was in Washington last December and met with several members of the House of Representatives who certainly didn't discount the possibility, who made private nods, saying that, yes, they believed that was the case. None have come out publicly yet and said so, but they may.
Right. Do you criticize Congressman McKinney for not having supported Barbara Lee on September 20th of last year when Bush got his blank check from Congress? I believe Barbara Lee was the only person who spoke up to oppose that.
Yeah, no, I don't criticize Congresswoman McKinney at all. I mean, it was clear that Barbara Lee's vote was not going to make a difference in the outcome. Cynthia McKinney has constituents to answer to, and she knows that her voting or not voting with Barbara Lee, who took a very courageous stand, would not have made a difference in the outcome. So, you know, when you're in politics, members of Congress have to judge when and how to fight, to fight their own battles on their own time. Cynthia's just bitten off a huge chunk with this. So.
Which brings us to our next question. How long do you believe Cynthia McKinney will survive politically?
She's tougher than anybody thinks. This is not a bad issue for her at all. This is the old political axiom, build it and they will come. There are many, many millions of people in this country who are totally suspicious of the government line about September the 11th. That she was the first to take a step, I think you will see a lot of support building for her, both at home in her own district, but also around the country, because she's right on the money.
Right. Well, is there any way besides letters and contributions that people who don't believe the official version of 911 or have suspicions about it could help legislators and officials who do speak out against the official version or ask for more investigation?
Well, I think that we're seeing a huge groundswell. One of the things that I'm very emphatic about is we have to try new things. Approaching activism or progressive issues the same way that had been done throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s doesn't apply in the post-9/11 world. Yet there are a whole lot of new things that are available. We have independent media. We have the Internet. We have My Newsletter from the Wilderness. We have lots of alternative or independent media sources now. And we encourage people to vote with their money to support IMCs, to support From the Wilderness, because the stronger we get, the more readers we get, the more viewers we get, the more people we can reach to really tell accurate stories that build support for these members of Congress. And that's a very important thing to do.
So do you see the primary battle right now being getting the real story out?
That's the only battle that counts. Okay.
Do you think legislators such as Cynthia McKinney and even Senator Daschle are in real danger of treason charges at some point?
No. That would be too politically dangerous for the Bush administration. And I need to say very clearly that I view the Bush administration now as being in deep trouble. And I think that the Bush administration is extremely vulnerable, both on corruption charges from Enron, some grand juries that I've been writing about and From the Wilderness, and all kinds of events around September the 11th. And campaign fundraising and so on and so forth. The Bush administration is much more vulnerable than people know that it is.
Are there other grand juries on other things besides Enron going on right now that you feel are making the Bush administration vulnerable?
Yeah, we have broken a major story in From the Wilderness. Seymour Hersh wrote a great piece for The New Yorker in July of 2000 called The Price of Oil. Following up on that, I've done my own investigation. There are two sitting federal grand juries, one in New York, one in Washington, investigating, among others, ExxonMobil and BP Amoco, those are two that I have identified, on charges of bribery to secure Kazakh oil from Kazakhstan, bribing government officials, and conducting an illegal oil swap through Iran in 1997. What's interesting is that both ExxonMobil and BP Amoco were major campaign donors to John Ashcroft. Now, we know that John Ashcroft immediately recused himself from the Enron investigation. Yet I have sources who are telling me that John Ashcroft is interfering with both of these grand juries when, in fact, ExxonMobil gave Ashcroft more money than Enron did, a total potentially criminal conflict of interest. What's interesting is that both ExxonMobil and BP Amoco got into Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force, the one about which we have all the secrecy, and around which President Bush is refusing to release the records. He's now redacted so many pages you don't know what's in there. What we know now is the two targets of federal felony grand jury investigations got into the vice president's task force, which is the same as having Manuel Noriega consult on the war on drugs. And what's worse is that the Kazakh government was involved in all of these crimes, the bribery and the oil swap. And during the period in time that this happened, Vice President Dick Cheney was sitting on the Kazakh government's oil advisory board. The Bush administration is criminally exposed all over the map, and this is what politicians are seeing in Washington, and I think Cynthia McKinney made a very wise move knowing how vulnerable the Bush administration really is.
What do you think our chances are of opening up the records once more, the presidential records?
The ones on the task force?
For one thing, the presidential records,
oh, right,
the papers, and all the records that have been sealed to try to to try to conceal any complicity or any like crimes that have occurred within the administration or within the people at least that are involved in the administration.
Well, that kind of depends on how far the people want to go, how much courage the people muster, how much voice we can muster to demand that. Now, President Bush did break the law when he refused to release the presidential records from the Reagan presidency and from the Bush presidency. He's obligated by law to do so. So he's released some, but held back some. That still breaks the law. That will be a tougher fight because it's not before the public's eyes right now. The Vice President's Energy Task Force, however, is the subject of a GAO suit that may go to the Supreme Court, but bear in mind Bush owns the Supreme Court. So this will be primarily a political fight that will be fought on a partisan level, and I'm not partisan one way or the other, but this is a fight that can really drag the Bushes out and make them look very bad.
And again, how you mentioned there needing to be public outcry to open the papers back up and basically open our government back up. How do you see what type of outcry would be effective? Letter writing or just campaign contributions?
It's a combination of things. Again, when I was in Washington in December, most members of Congress were still not getting their mail. So, you know, yes, that's a good thing, but it's not something that should be totally relied upon. I think the outcries through independent media sources are very important. And we're at a point in time now where the crisis in this country is so serious that we need to start thinking about things like going back to the streets like we did in the 60s and the 70s.
And, excuse me, how helpful are those people questioning the war and corporate influence while still accepting the official story of 9-1-1, such as Congressman Ron Paul of Texas and Representative Kucinich in Ohio?
Well, they're both brave men. They're both subscribers to my newsletter, so I'm not going to say too much bad about them. Ron Paul has been very brave, and both of them, I think, have serious questions about the official government line, but they have to walk the line of answering to their constituents who may not be ready to digest those kinds of issues yet. So I think they're fighting selective battles where they can. But they shouldn't be discounted. They've both said some wonderful things since September the 11th.
And how do the powers that be deal with your very vocal and public exposure of their lies? In other words, why are you still alive? That's a question from actually our newswire.
Well, I don't worry about why I'm still alive. I mean, now I have 20 members of Congress who subscribe to my newsletter. I'm read in 30 countries around the world, professors at 12 universities, so that if I were to suddenly turn up dead, that would be an affirmation that I was right. That would cause more trouble than it would solve. It's not something that I even think about for a minute. I will not die one minute before God, whoever she is, has decided. But aside from that, there is no more time for half measures. Now, you raised a little point earlier that I wanted to touch on. This is not a time to be a so-called safe progressive. This is not a time to pick up a primer and look and see what some progressive pundit decides your opinion should be. This is a total time to examine the facts and see where they lead you on your own and to speak fearlessly based upon the facts, the evidence that has been unearthed around September the 11th, and nothing else. No time for pedagogy or ideology at this time.
And is it true that your site has been repeatedly hacked, especially recently?
Yes, we've had two major, very professional hackings of the From the Wilderness website within the last 5 weeks. One of which was so professional or was so ruthless that they took out 150 websites just to get to mine. We have since moved to a very expensive high-tech site, and we doubt we're going to have any more problems. But we've also had physical burglaries of our offices within the last 6 weeks.
Really?
An outside storage area, yeah.
Wow. I was going to say, have you experienced any other patterns of recent harassment, I guess, besides the burglaries and the hacking?
Well, that and some very nasty and unfounded emails and a campaign that's utterly meritless within the so-called left or progressive movement with some completely inaccurate statements.
Who do you think is primarily behind the harassment, or is there no one organization?
Well,
no one frame of thought?
There's two ways to look at it, and I'm not sure that I've reached a total conclusion. One is, we know from the COINTELPRO area and the great work done by the activists in the 60s and 70s to unearth the records of the COINTELPRO program, that the powers that be, the government, the military, the FBI, CIA, have gone to the utmost lengths to infiltrate the so-called left or the progressive with people who become wolves in sheep's clothing for the specific purpose of being able to contain or control debate. Certainly, I think I've seen some of that here recently. On the other hand, there are those within, and I totally don't understand this, but there are some people who get caught up in petty or small turf interests or little kingdoms and fiefdoms who feel threatened. And, you know, that's not my issue at all. I don't come from that place. This is too critical a moment in human history. There's only one thing to do, which is talk about the evidence, not personalities. It's truly about principles more than it is personalities. It should be.
You may have just answered this question, but I'll ask it anyways. What is the source of your obvious passion in doing this work? What keeps you going?
Well, you would have to go into the long history of what happened to me some 25 years ago at LAPD. The fact that a woman I was in love with, who was a CIA agent, betrayed me. Of course, I found out she was dealing drugs, and I wouldn't get involved. Again, this is all extremely well documented in major papers. A police department that I believed in at the time betrayed me. But after I made my stand based upon principle, I was forced into poverty. I was homeless for 3 years, arrested, driven into bankruptcy. That was a pattern of harassment that lasted for a long time. I couldn't get a job anywhere. This was, you know, seen to because I was a whistleblower. And over the course of time in the years since, I have seen too many brave men and women who were within, either in the military or law enforcement, or various places, stand up and say the right thing at the right time and be utterly victimized for it. I reached a point, I crossed a Rubicon at some time, and it didn't matter to me anymore. There was nothing more they could do to hurt me. There was, you know, I didn't care. And as I've seen the situation get progressively worse and worse, there's just been basically no other choice for me but to do this. And I have kind of a Taoist or Buddhist viewpoint that this is the path that I was supposed to walk, so I surrender to it.
Do you think that's what it'll take to get the American public to decide to stand up and to decide to start paying more attention and to produce the outcry that would be necessary to expose the corruption, really, and how deeply it goes and change it?
It's a coin toss now as to whether the American people will wake up. I am traveling all over the country now. I'm lecturing all over the country, and soon Australia and Germany. I'll be traveling quite a bit. And my experience is that the people are waking up much more than most people really suspect that they are. I see the awakening taking place quickly. The question is one of commitment and people realizing the real peril that we're in since September the 11th and the fact that we're now dealing with an open dictatorship that's operating like a fascist dictatorship, that's operating like organized crime. And that it's a very serious state of affairs, much more so than the comfort that people had in the 60s, 70s, and 80s as they protested their causes.
Why do you think so many Americans, including progressives, are resistant specifically to looking for the truth about September 11th?
Denial is not a river in Egypt. The American system operates like a dysfunctional family, and I have seen this throughout the progressive movement too, with two symptoms. A dysfunctional family where the father is molesting the young daughter in the basement, and everybody in the family keeps quiet because they're afraid of the shame, they're afraid of what will happen, and they wind up scapegoating, and they don't want to look at the whole issue because it requires a level of inward searching, struggle, conflict that people are not willing to accept. The other is an issue of codependency, where I have seen within the progressive movement, it's an old joke about a wife showing up for treatment for codependency, and the therapist says, "How do you feel about coming to treatment?" And she says, "I don't know, I'll ask my husband." And
within the progressive movement, I have seen some, not all, I have seen a great many clear-headed thinkers, very courageous reporters and activists willing to look at the evidence ruthlessly. But then I've seen some and say, well, wait a minute, I have to see how I feel about 9/11. Let me read so-and-so, or let me read so-and-so and say what he says, and that will be my politically correct position. That's not healthy to me at all.
Which brings us to another question from our newswire. Has Noam Chomsky, to your knowledge, ever made any comment on you or on what you're saying?
I have heard people tell me that Noam Chomsky has said, first, that he's never heard of me, which I know is not true, because people have been carbon copying me emails that they have sent to him. And then I've heard someone tell me, and again, this is hearsay, or this is secondhand, that, you know, he said there's no merit to my research. Well, he's okay to say that if he wants to, but he still has to look at the evidence which I have presented, which is all documented. He has to deal with the facts. And if the facts contradict a vested interest, then he needs to prove himself to be the great thinker that people believe him to be and deal with the facts.
I recently read David Korn's article, and it seemed that his main point was simply that the American government simply couldn't do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
He spent a lot of time saying that, but he seemed to assume prima facie that it simply wasn't true, so none of your facts were valid.
Again, this is a classic case of attacking me rather than looking at the evidence that I have presented, which is documented. Anybody who's seen my Portland videotape knows that everything is sourced. I put the source information there, so you need to deal with the facts. And the issue in question was the case of Delmert Mike Vreeland in Canada, a former U.S. Naval Intelligence officer who was jailed in Canada. He's recently released on bail and granted refugee status in Canada, fighting extradition to the U.S. because he knows he's going to be killed here. Well, Korn's attack had nothing to do with the fact that I had traveled twice to Toronto, gotten the court record, interviewed his attorneys, interviewed Vreeland, had gone through the documentation, printed derogatory stuff about Vreeland, but I relied on the court record. Korn's attack didn't even look at that. Now, Korn is a case where I have to come back and say, and if I'm asked honestly, that I will say that I have an opinion that David Korn is one of the establishment CIA FBI operatives who has long been planted within so-called progressive circles, and the primary argument I use for that is that he was chosen by one of the most venal characters in American history, Ted Shackley, who ran the CIA station in Laos, who overthrew Salvador Allende, who was part of the anti-Castro operations, to be his chosen biographer. Out of all the people available, David Korn was picked to be the biographer for a man, and Korn completely covered up Shackley's history of drug trafficking. So, again, we have had some very interesting developments as a result of that. I spoke to Mike Vreeland in Canada. He was extremely offended by criticisms offered on my reporting, both by David Korn and Norman Solomon, which were, again, not based on anything to do with the research in the case, with the evidence. And Mike Vreeland drafted a letter, and I assisted him on his request, which was a direct and open challenge to both Korn and Solomon. Here I am. Come interview me. Talk about the record in the case. Talk about the documentation. You know, don't attack Rupert. Here I am. I'm not hiding. Rupert did the work you should have done. And since that time, both David Korn and Norm Solomon have been forced to contact Vreeland directly and to start addressing the facts of the case. And again, it's not about me or them. It's about the facts, because that's what tells the American people what's really going on behind 9/11.
Why is it not being covered by mainstream media? Why is the subject so censored?
Well,
or appear to be so censored?
I mean, this is a story which brings into question the legitimacy of the entire U.S. government. The entire so-called dysfunctional family falls apart if you take the issues of 9/11, as it would have had we looked at, honestly, CIA drug trafficking in the 80s, Iran-Contra savings and loan, Iraq gate, genocide in Rwanda, all of the issues that should have been fully, John F. Kennedy, that should have been dealt with fully years and years ago. Mainstream media has a vested interest in not telling this story because their economic survival depends upon operating in a system that people believe is legitimate. That's not.
Well, it actually brings us to a related question. A statement by someone on IMC to the effect that whoever killed Kennedy was incredibly powerful and has never been brought to justice. Whoever did it was not only able to kill the most protected man in the world, but has successfully prevented any investigation leading to the identity of the perpetrators, so they're still out there and still powerful. You obviously see connections, some sorts of connections or some similarity between 9/11 and the JFK assassination.
Well, in terms of a model, and one of the things that absolutely just makes me crack up laughing is this artificial framework that's been dumped by so-called progressive leaders onto this. And they say, well, we talk about systematic wrongs, and Rupert talks about a conspiracy between bad people. Well, that's a totally artificial construct. I mean, it's something that's thrown in that has absolutely nothing to do with the recipe of discovering the truth. Bad systems can create bad people, and bad people can create bad systems. But somewhere within the operation of a bad system that does bad things like kill people and run death squads, torture people, deal drugs, etc., 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 there are people who actually have to consciously do bad things. And somewhere in that mix, there has to come one question of accountability, personal, individual accountability. And I don't believe John Kennedy was killed by one man. I believe it was a swarm. There were a multitude of interests.
Who do you believe did
that wanted him dead?
What
well,
interest?
Certainly Wall Street had a massive interest. The CIA, I think, primarily facilitated that, and Mark Lane did great work. Peter Dale Scott, one of my all-time heroes, did great work, but the Mafia had an interest. Madame Trujillo from the Dominican Republic, Madame Nu from Vietnam, there was a whole multitude of people who benefited from John F. Kennedy's death. There was nobody to put the veto on it. CIA played an operationally coordinating role in the assassination.